for joining us. I'm Diane Rehm. Max suffered from depression, Marty from Alzheimer's. Max is a dog, Marty a cat. We think of many issues affecting the mind and brain, from OCD to PTSD and beyond, as human afflictions. But veterinarian and researcher Nicholas Dodman says we share the same neurochemistry as animals and that our minds and emotions work in similar ways. In a new book, he documents some of his experiences treating animals and makes the case for a new understanding of our pets and how their brains operate. His book is titled Pets on the Couch, Neurotic Dogs, Compulsive Cats, Anxious Birds, and the New Science of Animal Psychiatry. Nicholas Dodman joins me in the studio. We welcome your questions, comments at 800-433-8850. Send us an email to drshow@wamu.org. Follow us on Facebook or Twitter. Dr. Dodman, it's good to see you again.
It's very nice of you to have me back on, Diane. Thank you.
Always a pleasure. Let's begin by clarifying what you mean by neurotic dogs, compulsive cats. Are you saying that human beings and these creatures we adore so much really share the same kinds of emotions?
Absolutely. I think I knew that from a very young age, you know, as an uneducated, you know, 9-year-old. That was the feeling that I had that was, you know, taught to me by my mother, by watching by her example. And then there was the wave of science that swept over with veterinary school that sort of buried some of the thoughts for a while. But slowly, over the course of, you know, 46-year veterinary career and 35 years at Tufts, I came across case after case of animals with issues that looked for all the world like they were the animal version of an equivalent human condition.
Give me an example.
Well, where I first got involved was with the compulsive disorders that even in animals I like to call obsessive compulsive disorder, OCD. A lot of my friends would not appreciate the word obsessive because they'd say, you know, how do you know an animal thinks? Well, I think they think, and they look like they're obsessing, so I call it by the name I think it is. But, you know, I started with horses, and in the early days, you know, the repetitive disorders that horses show, which, you know, all equestrians know as stall vices, like biting at the edge of the stall or going continuously around in circles or digging at the ground, these sort of things, they were called stereotypies, which is a sort of sterile word, really, because it just means a pointless, mindless, repetitive disorder. And we studied these so-called stereotypies in horses, not realizing the human implications at that time, and then in dogs, and then in cats. And then it was a psychiatrist who I admire greatly from NIMH, Dr. Judith Rapoport, who wrote a wonderful book, The Boy Who Couldn't Stop Washing.
Of course, I remember talking with her.
And she got back to her office and found all these phone calls, phone messages saying, my dog does that, my dog does that. My well, great lady that she is, she didn't just dismiss it as, you know, which some would do, and how stupid, how could it possibly be, it's an animal. She took it seriously, looked into it, and showed that dogs with this compulsive wrist-licking behavior known as acral lick actually responded to the same medications that are used to treat human OCD over exactly the same time course, with exactly the same extent. And through the 90s, she touted the, you know, animal as a model of the human condition. And then, really, the blinkers fell off most of us, certainly me. And I went, oh, so that's what those repetitive disorders are. And all of a sudden, I saw them across the species, and there were cats who were pulling their fur out, which is the equivalent of human trichotillomania. There were dogs with that licking disorder. There were horses, and everything fit that paradigm. And in fact, you could look at it across the biological species from, you know, I had a chart in a textbook I wrote for a human psychiatry book, and it had the various species down the side, their natural behaviors, and the compulsive disorder that came from those natural behaviors when they went awry. And it was a perfect fit. It just, everything fell into place. And Dr. Rappaport kind of left the OCD model stuff and has been very interested recently in ADD, which dogs also get. But she's remained interested in my work. I've always been interested in her work.
Indeed. Now, does that mean that the same kinds of medications would work for an animal who perhaps suffers from OCD?
Absolutely. So, you know, originally it was a kind of almost a joke, especially with media that, oh, pets taking Prozac. You know, I mean, in fact, the first national TV slot I ever did was on Michael Moore's TV Nation, entitled Pets on Prozac. And it wasn't really a send-up. He did a very nice job, but it was just like, can you believe it? But the fact is, if you believe that dogs suffer from what I would call OCD, and they can't help themselves in this behavior, which can end up in sort of self-destruction, you know, ulceration, deep infections, and they respond to Prozac or Zoloft or Paxil, I mean, why wouldn't you use a good treatment instead of the old ones that vets used to use that don't work?
Are the dosages related then to size or species or what?
Yeah, you do need to scale for the species. So, you know, if I was to pick a sort of middle-of-the-road dose out of the hat, it would be for an animal, which is probably higher than for a person, is 1 milligram per kilogram of body weight. But, for example, if you're treating a bird like a parrot that has OCD in the form of feather plucking, because of their high metabolic rate, you have to scale the dose up. So they would take closer to 2.5 to 3 milligrams per kilogram of body weight.
Wow. Very surprising. And you have seen results of these medications at work.
Absolutely. I mean, one of them was kind of surprising. I got sort of involved peripherally as the person to advise about Prozac for a polar bear in the Calgary Zoo. I think it was Calgary. And it was pacing mindlessly. And they had lots of scientists studying it. The bear was filmed for like 17 hours a day. And they said, would Prozac work with this compulsive pacing? And I said, it should do. And I scaled the dose for them for a polar bear. And bears, of course, are related to dogs. And the scaled dose I came up with was 0.5 milligram per kilogram, which they tried, and the effect was minimal. So we upped it to 1 milligram per kilogram, and the bear stopped pacing without sedation.
Without sedation. That's a key point. You know, in your book, Pets on the Couch, you also talk about creatures with Alzheimer's. How do you know a cat may have Alzheimer's?
Well, a little jingle that we use to diagnose it in dogs and cats and other species would be, it's an acronym, DISH. So D is for disorientation, I is for altered social interactions, S is for sleep disturbances, sometimes looking a bit like the human sundowner syndrome. And H is for, you know, losing the place in terms of the bathroom, which actually happens to people with Alzheimer's too, that they have accidents in places they shouldn't and end up wearing diapers and so on. So it's just from signs. And even in humans, there's no definitive diagnosis. It's really a post-mortem diagnosis. If you know the signs and you rule out other possibilities, you can make that pretty positively, that diagnosis, and then you treat, and the treatment often works for a while, but the disease is relentless, will eventually catch up. But on post-mortem, the changes in the cat's brain and the dog's brain, and the big cat's brain, as a matter of fact, I talk about one in the book, that they have the same changes in terms of the accumulation of amyloid protein in plaques and the tangles of the protein called tau.
Is there any medication that seems to help with these creatures?
Well, it's a little bit scattergun. It's, of course, the same scatter of drugs are used in animals as are used in people. But some drugs are designed to increase the neurotransmitter dopamine, which is the one that connects thought with action. So, say, for example, a monoamine oxidase inhibitor, which was an old-fashioned type of antidepressant, increases dopamine, and that's reasonably effective in animals. I believe the trade name in humans is Elderpril. It's not quite as effective in them. But for dopamine, acetylcholine, glutamate, the whole lot.
Dr. Nicholas Dudman, his new book is titled Pets on the Couch, Neurotic Dogs, Compulsive Cats, Anxious Birds, and the New Science of Animal Psychiatry. Do join us. I look forward to speaking with you.
DCS Daily.
DCS Daily.
DCS Daily.
It's news,
culture, and curiosities.
From the District, Tacoma Park,
Alexandria,
Friendship Heights,
Hyattsville,
Falls Church,
Northeast Washington, D.C., in your inbox every weekday afternoon.
DCS Daily. Sign up at dcs.com/newsletter.
dcs.com/newsletter.
And welcome back. Renowned veterinarian Nicholas Dudman is with me. He has written many, many books. He is at Tufts University, where he's been director of the Animal Behavior Department of Clinical Sciences since the 1980s. Where he actually founded the Animal Behavior Clinic. He's written The Dog Who Loved Too Much, The Cat Who Cried for Help, Dogs Behaving Badly, and If Only They Could Speak. His latest book is titled Pets on the Couch. And Dr. Dudman will join us a few minutes past noon on Facebook to answer your questions. I'll be there with Maxie, we'll talk about Maxie's ailments, and we'll be streaming that so you can participate with us live. That'll be right after 12 noon. You also talk in this book about depression in animals. Give us an example. You talk about Max.
Well, a lot of people wonder, you know, could an animal possibly be depressed? And the answer is a resounding yes. And oftentimes, under the same circumstances that we would be depressed. For example, bereavement, and it could be bereavement of a loved human companion or fellow canine companion. And they go into this funk. You know, life seems to be gray. Things that interest them before, they're not interested in. They don't play very much. They sleep a lot during the day. They might be off their food and not want to go for walks, and they just generally, they lose weight. They're just generally not themselves, and it coincides precisely with the loss of this companion.
You know, early on in our marriage, my husband and I had two cats, and we had them for 8 or 10 years, and then one of the two cats, sadly, was hit by a car, and the other did exactly as you say. He was a changed creature, whereas previously the two had gone out together every single day to play together, to wander together, to come back together. Now the remaining one really had very little interest in life for quite a while. But I must tell you, he lived until age 23. So he was quite a cat. But that bereavement period lasted a long time.
Yeah, I had one, that a cat that went into such severe anorexia, meaning not eating, that actually it suffered a condition that cats get when they don't eat. Sometimes it's called hepatic lipidosis, or accumulation of fatty tissue inside the liver, which interferes with liver function, can cause them to become jaundiced, and oftentimes it's fatal. And this cat was going in that direction. And our ICU managed to salvage the physical side of things, and I treated that cat with an old-fashioned antidepressant, amitriptyline, and it came out of its funk. It's only a case series of one, but the fact is I see these things all the time, and we do sometimes put things together in a series and publish them, but I know lots of other things that I've not managed to pull series together on, and I write about some of those as stories in the book.
You talk about some really serious diseases that we associate sometimes with genetics, for example, epilepsy or even autism in creatures.
Yeah, the autism we sort of stumbled across that because for 30 years now I've been interested in tail chasing in dogs, which was originally described as a stereotypy. And then the bandwagon joined in and it was called a compulsive disorder. But I was never totally happy with that diagnosis because they had some neurological things that were going on too, seemed to be associated with seizures. We did some studies of brains, and there was hydrocephalus in a large number. That's water on the brain, enlarged cavities inside the brain. And it just really wasn't a clear-cut idea. So when we did our first genetic study on canine OCD, which proved positive, I didn't volunteer the bull terriers for it, even though they were dear to my heart, because I thought it was a, quotes, dirty model. So we did a large series of 333 bull terriers comparing affected and control. And when we came to look at it statistically, comparing the two groups, affected and control, the things that emerged were perplexing to myself and co-researcher Dr. Alice Moon-Finelli. We just sat in my office, I remember that day, and she said, how are we going to explain the fact that the statistician tells us it's more common in males? How are we going to explain the fact that these dogs go into this sort of staring, trancing type behavior? How are we going to explain this association with explosive aggression? And all of a sudden I said, wait a minute. Got the computer up. We looked at autism. They were exactly the same signs. So we tried to publish that in a highbrow journal, and they said, just because it looks like it doesn't mean it is. And unless you come up with some biomarkers, some things you can measure, we're not going to believe you, we're not going to publish it. So we found out that in children with autism, they have high levels of a peptide called neurotensin and elevated levels of a sort of stress hormone. Both these things we looked at in the bull terriers, and sure enough, they were elevated. So we published a paper that was children with these things elevated, bull terriers with these things elevated, and the signs in a pretty decent journal called Translational Psychiatry, which is one of the Nature series of journals. So it was accepted, peer-reviewed. Autism in dogs is on the map.
Heavens.
And that was just looking at one breed, because we always look at one breed. It doesn't mean that's the only...
Oh, I see. Yeah. You would have to stay with one breed, I would think.
Especially for when we're doing the genetic studies, so we focused on Dobermans and Bull Terriers. More recently, we've got a cohort of German Shepherds and tail-chasing German Shepherds and light-chasing Border Collies, which are in line for analysis at NIH, as a matter of fact.
Now, Tourette's syndrome is something you should explain first, how it appears in humans. But you have actually treated horses with Tourette's.
Yeah, when we first found the first horse with it, we had no idea what it was, but we were called down into a barn in Connecticut to look at a very fine, very valuable breeding quality Arabian stallion. I mean, he was valued in those days at $200,000. He was an expensive horse. But when he wasn't breeding, he would be in his stall like the man in the Iron Mask, covered in a blanket to stop him from hurting himself. He would twitch and turn and twist and vocalize, and he literally had an iron mask on to try and minimize the damage. In case the blanket came on, there was the muzzle and the muzzle. And we studied him in this big arena, and using the only tool we had at the day, which was the drugs, a drug called Narcan, which is very famous these days for treating opioid addiction. It's an opiate antagonist. So we treated the horse with that, and with increasing doses, the frequency went down. So we thought, well, it's very interesting. It's not quite a compulsive disorder. So we pulled together a large series of horses. I believe it was 57 horses, scoured the country, got all these records together, put them together. Like the bull terriers, we came up with a list of signs that went together. And, you know, for example, it was involved a large head neck motor tic. You know, they twist to one side or something with head movement. They had what's called hemibolismus, which is one limb suddenly flying away, which is a feature of Tourette syndrome in people. They did a lot of sniffing. They were preoccupied with the periphery of their stall. They had problems with junctures going across a division from, say, inside the stall. There's like a line, and now you're on a different surface. They had problems with that. And long story short, when we looked at all the signs and compared them with Tourette syndrome in people, they were the same. So then we called in the Tourette Syndrome Association and showed them the horse and videotapes and whatever, and a series of horses. And they said, we totally believe you. And actually, the first horse, Pepper Bell, who's in the book, this whole story, but Pepper Bell became an insignia for the Tourette Syndrome Association. And we went around schools in Massachusetts with this horse, Pepper, who was a winner. A quarter mile, you know, a quarter horse who would win at a quarter mile. But then he went to the high schools and had all the middle school and everything there too, and he'd run around the school track pulling a sulky with the jockey on the back in all his beautiful silks. And they say, you see what a wonderful... They all wanted a pet Pepper. It was so wonderful. Then they showed video of Pepper winning races inside and then doing the strange bucking, squealing type behavior. And the message was, just because you're not completely normal doesn't mean you're not a winner.
Precisely.
And the kids got it.
How early did those symptoms show up in these animals?
Well, that was another thing. So the average age of onset was 18 months. And you might say, well, that's not the same as people. Children tend to get it at the age 7 is when it shows up. But actually, 18 months on a horse lifespan is exactly the same as 7 on a human lifespan.
So, treatment, again, similar, different.
So the Tourette Syndrome Association kindly gave us a grant to study the drugs that are used to treat Tourette syndrome, including the Prozac-like drugs. But we had a scheme, actually. We had drugs that stimulated and blocked dopamine, drugs that stimulated and blocked serotonin. And actually, on that study, which we published, every drug in the horse model, and it was a group of horses, it wasn't just one, worked in pretty much the same way as they do in humans. And we came to the conclusion that, you know, especially using a serotonin drug like Prozac or clomipramine, these were probably a good background to sort of at least get things under control. And that pretty much is the standard treatment for Tourette syndrome in people.
And it worked in the horse in what ways?
Well, there was one horse in there. I think it was the first horse we saw in that stable in Connecticut. Probably shouldn't mention his name. Oh, it's in the book, Migdol. So his mum allowed us to treat Migdol for longer, like 3 or 4 weeks, and the behavior dropped to sort of 25% of what it was. And then she took Migdal back home and continued the medication over the whole rest of the summer. And by the end of the summer, he was barely showing the signs at all. And actually, when she discontinued the medicine for reasons of expense, he never got back to the original level.
He never did. That's what I wondered about, whether you're talking about reduction of symptoms to such a point where they kind of disappear in the brain.
Well, sometimes you can, you know, go in there with a screwdriver and sort of turn something and it stays turned for a while at least. So I know, for example, in human OCD, that people go to see their psychiatrist and, you know, you're not put on it for like 10 days, like a course of antibiotics. If you're put on Zoloft, it's, say, let's try it for a year.
Yeah.
And then they go back and they say, well, you're doing very well. Would you like to try reducing the dose? They say, yeah, let's try it. And oftentimes it will return. The sad thing is that sometimes when you reintroduce it, you don't get the same benefit.
And you're listening to the Diane Rehm Show. There are lots of listeners asking about the causes of some of these behavioral issues and whether humans cause these by keeping animals in captivity.
Well, it's multiple causes, but we know, for example, that there is a genetic predisposition. So in that Doberman model, where we looked at a strange behavior, which is kind of really derived from suckling, called blanket suckling or flank sucking, we found a gene called neural cadherin, which is a brain. It lives in the brain. It works in the brain. It works in centers relevant. It's since been confirmed in a different dog model, and more recently by a friend of mine in South Africa in humans with OCD. Same gene. Sets you up for it. But it's quite true that you could have the genetic setup for the condition and not actually be triggered. So you do need this pressure cooker effect of life. And I think the same happens to people. So I guess I ventured in the book that real hominids, for example, the natives of Papua New Guinea who are living in the forests and living like real ancient humans, do not have the same. Their concerns are real. They're about where the next meal is coming from, personal safety. They don't get OCD. So we're really, as Desmond Morris would say, humans in the concrete jungle, and the pressures of modern life and the flickering computer screen and dodging cars and the traffic and, you know, marriages and divorces, we end up in the same pressure as the dogs who are kept in the house without the ability to fulfill their biological objectives.
You know, it's really stunning when you think about how closely we interact with these creatures and the extent to which they affect us and we affect them rather than have them living out in their natural environment. And yet we are told we give these creatures homes, especially ones who've been abused or neglected, and whose lives are turned around, literally, by being brought into the home.
That's true. Their lives are saved. But there is a little subtle twist there, and that is it depends on the home they go into. So if you take the ever-so-common problem of separation anxiety, which affects quite a few adoptees from that situation, they're so pleased to finally have someone to depend on that they worry that they're going to be left forever. You know, that kind of condition is it's a really tricky, hard nut of a question to answer. But those guys, they've had an abused life. They may have some genetic predisposition for it. And, of course, incidentally, children get that condition too.
Dr. Nicholas Dodman, his new book is titled Pets on the Couch. When we come back, our lines are filled. We'll try to get to as many of your calls as we can. Stay with us. And welcome back. Time to open the phones. We'll go first to Molly in St. John's, Michigan. You're on the air.
Thank you so much for taking my call. This is a great show. Dr. Dodson, my husband, like you, is a veterinarian as well as a board-certified family physician, and I'm a therapist, and we have a little dog whose behavior has us completely stumped. He's a little Sheltie Collie, and he becomes completely unglued after a strange constellation of sounds, such as eggs being cracked, beaters on a handheld mixer cause him to have these behaviors, the shades being pulled up and down.
How about the vacuum cleaner?
Drives him wild.
Yeah.
He attacks it. And he runs in circles. He barks. It makes it almost impossible to even bake with him because he is so upset every single time you crack an egg or use the beaters. And it feels a lot like an anxiety kind of disorder, but I just feel so badly for him because he is constantly in the state of really heightened anxiety.
And let me ask you, have you talked to a vet about any prescription medicine for him?
You know, we've never considered it. And as I said, my husband's in the profession, as am I, but in the field, we haven't talked about actually using any medication. And that's why I was so interested in the work of Dr. Dodson, because I think he would benefit from it.
Well, I agree. We see quite a few of these cases, and I wouldn't say, you know, I see one every week, but it's not uncommon to have a dog that has multiple sound phobias that just really becomes unglued with a collection, a plethora of sounds from, you know, the beeping of the fire extinguisher to the microwave to egg cracking electric machines, and they just go completely burlesque. Well, the fact is there are so many things causing the problem, you can't desensitize to all of them, which would be the, you know, for a fearful phobic type condition, that would be the gold standard. But when it's multiple phobias like that, you have to make some. You can avoid some of the things. Obviously, you could take them out of the room when you're cracking eggs, but you know, you're walking on eggs. Then you're living a tricky life. So I think medicine is the right thing. As Diane suggests, I think that would be a good idea. And you know, you could do something fairly innocuous. Like there's a very side effect free anti-anxiety drug called buspirone. It's so harmless. There's no sedation, there's no addiction, there's no withdrawal, there's no organ toxicity that I've ever encountered in using it for 30 years, I think, since 1996 or 7, seven, I think, 1987. I wouldn't hesitate to put him on buspirone. And what size is he?
Well, I'm not exactly sure how much he weighs, but he's pretty small. He's a Sheltie Collie.
For your husband's sake, about 1 milligram per kilogram twice a day.
Yeah. Yeah, that sounds good. Well, the other part that's kind of interesting is it's far worse when I am involved. I'm sort of his alpha. You know, I feed him and he follows me everywhere. Other people can crack eggs or use the beaters. It's mainly, and he never does it at anyone else's house, but when I'm involved, and we've wondered about him feeling him worried that something's causing me harm when he hears these sounds.
Well, you could, there might be an attention-seeking component to it, that he knows that mommy's going to come to his rescue, so he acts out more. So you could try making a neutral sound like a whistle or something and then just exiting stage right, either just psychologically or physically leave the area when he's having his tizzies. and if that was involved at all, it would be pretty much completely fixed in 3 weeks, with or without medicine.
Interesting. Good luck to you, Molly. Let's go to Elkhart, Indiana. Hi, Jackie. You're on the air.
Hi. I have a little Senegal parrot, about 22 years old, that I inherited from my folks. And he was a rescue parrot. He was bred for selling, but the people didn't treat him well. If he chirped, they whacked his cage with a broomstick.
Nice.
The behavior that really interested me, he suggested to me, I'm the only constant that's been in his life all these years. And one day I found a picture of my parents sitting on a couch laughing and happy. And I was putting that in Christmas cards to send to my cousins, and he flew to see what I was doing, and he looked at that picture. And I know he recognized my parents, and he looked at it for a little bit, and then he gathered himself up in as small a ball as he could, and he laid his little beak on that picture, and he kept saying, "Her, her, her." And, you know, they don't cry. They don't weep tears, but I know he was grieving for my parents. And I just thought that was, you know, interesting behavior.
Wow, that is very bizarre. I don't think I've heard that story before, but certainly they can see very well. Birds have wonderful eyesight and amazing color vision. I'm sure he could pick them up. And, you know, there might have been some element of him picking up on your feelings also.
Interesting. To Johnny in Pittsburgh, Pennsylvania, you're on the air.
Thank you. I have a small dog who 2 years ago had very bad seizures. And since then, she no longer barks or wags her tail. She doesn't seem to recognize me. She can sort of see out of one eye. She cannot hear any longer. It's almost like she may have a brain tumor, which we can do nothing about. But it may be a combination of that and just some sort of cognitive disorder. And I want to know, what is she feeling? Is she stressed out? Is she depressed while this is happening? What is there anything I can do? I don't know if she even recognizes me any longer.
So just tell me one thing. I've missed how old she is now.
She was a rescue, so I'm not sure, but I believe she should be around 14 years old.
So she's 14 years old.
She's a Maltese poodle Shih Tzu mix.
Maltese poodle with a Shih Tzu. So also, is she on any medicine for the seizures?
Yes, she's on a series of medications that can control any more seizures, and she has had no seizures in the 2 years.
I wonder if she might be over-medicated, you know, which would sort of obtund her if they were using the usual sort of drug of first choice for most vets would be phenobarbital. And, you know, if the dose is a little bit high, they can end up pretty much out of it. And then you see things that you're seeing now. And it happens in nursing homes to people, too, that they're over-medicated and they actually falsely diagnosed with Alzheimer's, and in fact when you get the medicines adjusted down, the person comes back. So you could speak to your vet about that. That blood level should not be over 30 for sure, and there may be some better anticonvulsants that you could splice in that could get you. But on the other hand, it's certainly possible she could have a brain tumor, and it's certainly possible that there's something else going on. That one really would demand a very careful evaluation, perhaps an MRI.
John, thanks for calling. Dr. Dodman, you had a rescue dog of your own, Jasper. Tell us about Jasper.
Well, Jasper's a dear, sweet dog. He's when I got him, he'd been, I think his owner was probably too busy to have a dog. That was the situation. So, I mean, she wasn't cruel on purpose, but she was a little thoughtless, perhaps. And she would be at work all day and leave him in a small crate that was only big enough really for a puppy. I think it was his puppy crate, which, you know, wrecked. He ended up with a scar on his back. And then she didn't feed him on a regular basis. So he weighed about 45 pounds. He was in that crate, long story short, for 23 hours a day. And my daughter called me because she went to stay in that apartment, revisiting her alma mater, Tufts University undergrad school. And said, "Dad, Mum," because Mum's a vet too, you got to do something about this dog. We say, you know, unfortunately, I don't know what we can do. And we were actually contemplating, you know, cruelty reporting or something of that nature when suddenly something very fortuitous struck that the dog actually got into a whole bunch of Tampax and ate the lot. And with the intestinal obstruction, the owner now could not, he weighed 45 pounds and he was voraciously hungry, ate this material and started to vomit. The vet quoted $3,000 for the surgery, which actually is a pretty decent price, but she couldn't afford it, so she was going to have him put to sleep. So we said, "I tell you what, we'll take him, we'll do the surgery for nothing, and we'll find the right home for him." Well, the fact is, there was no home that was good enough for Jasper, We really seriously did intend to place him with someone who had more time. But he grew, you know, to be my other dog, Rusty's best friend, and we grew to love him.
So you took him in after a long discussion with her. She didn't want to give him up.
She didn't, and I had her, both of her parents. It was her biological mother and her stepmother from Florida called and said, you know, really, she didn't know what she was doing. It was just a difficult time for her. We'll take the dog back to Florida, and we'll, one of us is a dog trainer anyway, we'll train the dog, and then we'll give her in a year. We said, like, really, you know, if you don't have that sort of feeling that connects with an animal, you can actually allow that to happen, then you're not going to get it. You know, you don't sort of suddenly acquire empathy.
And you still have Jasper.
Yes, I was just, right before the show, I was calling my wife, say, how's Jasper? Because he cut his foot the other day. I said, how's his foot? She said, he was still a bit sore on it, but this, that, and the other. I say, because he's such a sweet dog. He's got these big brown eyes. I'm not used to looking into the big brown eyes because Rusty's got amber eyes, but they're big black pools. He's black and tan.
What kind coonhound. Of a dog is he?
He's probably a coonhound of mix, but he's black and tan, and he's got these fawn eyebrows and a beautiful muzzle, so expressive, and he looks like he's smiling all the
sure.
time. And he's such a cool dog. He's a little bit independent, but very, very affectionate too. You know he loves you, but he's not one of these clingy dogs. The other one, Rusty's more clingy. Jasper's sort of independently in love with us.
And how did they interact? How did they when you first brought Jasper home?
Well, we were worried. We thought that Rusty would have his nose put out of joint, and sure enough, he looked a little miffed for the first couple of days, like, who's this other dog in my house eating out of my bowl? But then after a while, it was like, well, hey, he's all right, because Jasper's so low-key. And incidentally, Jasper, who weighed 45 pounds when I got him,
now weighs
85.
Wow.
So he was 40 pounds underweight because he's not fat now. He's deep-chested. He's, you know, cut. You can see his abdomen going up, and he runs like the wind. But there was this skin-and-bone plate rack when I got him. And if I give him a food treat, he'd practically take my fingers off. Now I can offer it to him. He knows there will be another opportunity, so he just takes it gently.
That's lovely. You know, I think we have no idea how many dogs there are like Jasper and how many cats there are in that same situation where people think they want an animal, but number one, have no idea of how to care for one, and number two, have no time for that creature. Dogs and cats take time. I mean, any pet, any creature takes time and care, and too many people don't know how. And you're listening to the Diane Rehm Show. Let's go to St. Louis, Missouri. Hi, John. You're on the air.
Hi, Diane. Thanks for taking my call.
Sure.
I have a question about a cat that I have. I think this cat was taken too young from her mother because when we got her, she was very small. And she's always had a sort of ambivalent relationship towards affection. She very much wants to be petted and stroked, and then she likes to finish it off with a good bite and clawing you. So I wondered if maybe getting taken away from her mother too early could have some sort of lasting emotional effect. And I'm particularly worried about it right now because I'm about to move her across country, and I have to drive her 10 hours. And I don't want to incur any more psychological damage to this cat that I really have come to love.
Well, it's true that the early adoption can lead to all kinds of problems, and you know, nursing on earlobes and fingers, and over attachment, and sometimes, you know, even sort of a feisty type of aggression. Just tell you a story. My own cat, Griswold, who's deaf, he was a bit bitey when I first got him, and he would roll on his side and ask to be petted, and I would pet him, and then he'd nip. So every time he nipped, I just stood back. My wife was a little bit more positive that she would actually tap him on the nose, bop, and then say no, because he couldn't hear that. But he saw the look in her eyes, felt the touch on his nose, and we would stop, and he doesn't do it at all now. So that's a very simple treatment, but there's a lot going on with your cat and more than we have time to talk about
indeed
on the air.
And one last quick call, because you mentioned this earlier, Kurt in Raleigh, North Carolina, if you can be very brief, please.
All right. Thank you, Diana. Enjoy your show. Best wishes in the future. We have a cocker that's 18 months old, weighs about 34 pounds, and he was raised on a cocker farm. So the situation is that he's been gnawing a lot. He sort of has sort of a rash. I've talked to the vet about changing his food. We're now feeding him salmon and sweet potato, and she also recommended doing fish oil. And I guess my question is that is that an alternative to prescription drugs, or is it really necessary for me to buy the fish oil from them at a much higher expense than I can across the counter?
You can buy fish oil over the counter. Just make sure it doesn't have too high a level of vitamin A in it. Otherwise, you can end up with hypervitaminosis A. Too much is a bad thing. So pure fish oil or, you know, even omega-3s are palliative when it comes to skin conditions. But it does sound like there's some allergy situation going on. There are allergy tests that, a vet or dermatologist can do. And actually, if you find out what the dog's allergic to and avoid it, it's a good idea. Most vets do what yours is doing. They go straight to the food thing, the food trial. But in fact, only about 6% of all allergies are due to food, and only about 4% are due to protein. So that's a long shot. You're better to find out what's allergic to. But there's some amazing anti-allergy drugs out these days. One of them, for example, is called Apoquel.
Dr. Duttman, you might want to make sure to get your website up.
Oh, yes. We're doing a study, too long to explain all about it, but it's about the interaction of pets and people, the effect that you can have on your dog's behavior. And it's sort of really about the dyad, which is the owner and the pet. Hmm. You can read about it on drdodman.org or com. D-R-D-O-D-M-A-N, drdodman.org or .com.
And Nicholas Dodman, veterinarian, has been my guest. His new book is titled Pets on the Couch. So good to have you here. Thank you.
So good to be back. Thank you, Diane.
And I hope you'll join us on Facebook after the show. Dr. Dodman's going to answer your animal questions on Facebook Live. I'll be there, too, with my little dog, Maxie, and certainly questions of my own. Thanks for listening, all. I'm Diane Rehm.